Okay, thank you so much. So I kind of like the pace here, going from practice to more conceptual back to practice. So just to complicate things a little bit further, much of what I discuss in this talk is actually going to be giving examples to many of the concepts that Professor Diaz-Roux discussed in her talk. And so I hope then together this makes a more formative whole, just in the nature of complex systems. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So I want to start with a simple story at the very foundations of epidemiology. And many of you who've studied public health will know who this gentleman on your left is, and that's John Snow, who's known to be the great founder of epidemiology. And the reason we know about him is because in 1854, he very heroically removed the pump handle from the Broad Street pump to halt one of the greatest cholera epidemics in London. And he did some very technical geospatial analyses for the time, realized that this was the pump that was responsible for a lot of the burden of cholera, and removed that pump despite the protestations of many of the folks in the Department of Health at the time. So this is John Snow, the hero. But if we look a little bit closer at some of the data regarding the cholera epidemic of 1854, perhaps the story becomes a little bit more complex. And in particular, I want to point to you the fact that the pump closed well after the greatest burden of deaths. Notice deaths being a very lagged indicator of the incidence of cholera. So after the greatest burden of deaths had already taken place, and this is when the pump closes. So we go from a very simple story about the founding of epidemiology to what is a much more complex reality. And what I want to discuss today is how we can think about these very complex realities such that we can color our understanding of population health in ways that hopefully educates the way that we can intervene. What we're engaged in epidemiology is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease in populations. And increasingly, authors have discussed that we have a very specific teleological end to this, and that's so that we may intervene to improve population health. So ultimately, what we're trying to do is understand distributions and determinants such that we can then educate interventions. And so then the question becomes, how do we think about interventions? How do we think about what works in epidemiology? What would be the ideal policy experiment in this particular science? So what we'd do is we'd start with a population. This is 144 individuals, if you're counting. And we're exposing them now to an exposure, here being the red lightning bolt. Okay? And after the red lightning bolt happens upon them, some mechanistic change ensues, and after some period of time, some number of them pass away. Okay? So we now then have an answer to what the red lightning bolt does, right? Not so fast. Because the problem is we need a contrast. We don't actually know whether or not the deaths were caused by the red lightning bolt or were caused by something else that happened to happen at the same time as the red lightning bolt. So ideally what we would do is, to produce a contrast, we would take the exact same population in the exact same space, in the exact same time, and we would expose them to something different. Here, the yellow lightning bolt. Okay? And we have a different mechanistic change that ensues, a different outcome. And at this point, we then, by contrasting the effects of the red and the yellow lightning bolt, can say something about the effects of each relative to one another. This is what we call counterfactual reasoning in epidemiology. We observe a fact, and then we compare it to a hypothesized counterfactual in our mind so as to say something about what the effects of an exposure were onto a population. Okay? What we're doing in system science approaches in epidemiology, some of the things that Professor Diaz-Roux discussed, are using computer simulations to model out some of these counterfactuals in ways that we actually can't do in real life. But when you're building a population, a simulation, we have a number of pieces of the model we now have to pay attention to. And here are some of the assumptions that she discussed in her talk. So we have a baseline population. They're exposed to something. Some mechanistic change ensues, and ultimately an outcome. So that gives us control over about three of these, right? Ultimately, good science says that you shouldn't have control over your outcomes, right? So we really do have control over a population that we start with, the exposures that we expose them to, and ultimately the mechanisms that we assume, or we hypothesize more importantly, beget the outcomes following the exposures. We then have to target one of those for inference. We want to understand something about one of those characteristics. The most obvious is to target the exposure itself, right? To then think about contrasting outcomes across different exposures on the same baseline population. Less obvious, though, might be to think about differences in the baseline population itself. We might know something about the way an exposure works, the effect of the particular exposure, but we might not understand how, when that exposure is deployed onto a population that we don't know very much about, what the effects might look like. And then potentially the least obvious is to think about how the mechanisms of action might operate between exposure and outcome. Oftentimes we try something in a randomized trial, and then we show that it works, and we're not really worried about how it works. But often the devil's in the details. And so what these models allow us to do are to hypothesize different effects of exposures, mechanistic productions of outcomes, and to think about how those might work relative to each other. So then the other question is, these models aren't all that helpful unless you can base them in reality, right? You want to be able to say something about a real population on whom you want to intervene. And so that gives you two potential states of reality: reality before an exposure and reality after an exposure. And then two potential approaches to validation, to basing the model in reality. The first is to just start with a realistic pre-exposure population, a population that looks like the population in which you're interested. The second, and maybe not as obvious, is to think about a population contrast, to think about what the effects of a population of exposure on a particular population might look like, and then look at whether or not the exposures and mechanisms that you're testing beget the outcome from where you started. So I want to just step back and show you an example from our own work. And that starts with this paper published in 2007 by Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler in the New England Journal of Medicine. They looked at the spread of obesity in a large social network in Framingham over 32 years. And what they found was if, for example, your friend is obese, your likelihood of becoming obese in the next 3 years increases about 57%. They concluded that their study suggests that obesity may spread in social networks in quantifiable and discernible pattern that depends on the nature of social ties. Now, I'm not going to talk specifically about any of the potential methodological issues with the paper. Those have been discussed, and you can read about them elsewhere. I want just to think about the effect of this with respect to policy. Okay, so this paper was cited 2,500 times, and it garnered a substantial amount of attention in the lay media. Here you see from the New York Times, obesity spreads to friends, study concludes, and a little bit more alarmingly in the UK, are your friends making you fat? We wanted to just ask a question. Take the individual level inference from their paper and think about the implications for a population. If you targeted the most well-connected people in a population, could you improve the efficacy of an anti-obesity intervention? And that's the question we wanted to test. How does this play with public health, the way that we think about public health policy? So what we did is we built an agent-based model to simulate this question. It featured a cohort of 10,000 agents who aged from 18 to 65 years. We placed each of those agents in neighborhoods by social class and ethnicity to mimic spatial segregation that we see in real life. And then that spatial segregation had implications for the types of social relationships they formed, because people form friendships with people with whom they live. We used data from the Health Survey from England in 1999 and 2004 to parameterize baseline demographics and the demographic and neighborhood influences on obesity risk in this model. We then picked the network effect directly out of Christakis and Fowler's paper and implemented it in our paper, such that if an agent was obese, the likelihood of another agent with whom it was friends to become obese in the next 3 years increased 57%. Okay? And then obesity risk over the life course was then calculated based on these demographic factors and social contexts over time. We tested two separate interventions, okay? So that was the baseline population, and now we're testing interventions within that synthetic population. The first is a prevention intervention that keeps 10% of the population overall from becoming obese at any time, okay? The second was a treatment intervention, which artificially cures 10% of the population who is obese at any given time step, okay? So these are the interventions. And what we did is we implemented these interventions in different ways relative to a baseline, okay? Baseline with no intervention. And then we implemented at random, so we just picked random people and gave them the intervention, or we targeted the most well-connected people in our synthetic population and implemented them among them. And the question that we asked is, does the targeted intervention outperform the intervention implemented at random? I.e., does targeting the most well-connected people actually make your intervention better? And this is what we found. So here you see life course obesity prevalence in our model at baseline in black, and then at random in blue, and targeted in red. And you'll take two findings away from this. First, the prevention intervention wasn't all that helpful. And second, more importantly, targeting didn't improve the efficacy of the intervention at all. Okay? We then looked at the treatment intervention. We found effectively the same thing. Granted, now if you're treating 10% of the obese population every year, this is going to be an effective intervention, right? But more importantly, the take-home point here is that targeting didn't improve the efficacy of the intervention at all. Okay? But this is what's really cool about these models. So I told you that initially we built the model using the obesity communicability parameter directly out of Christakis and Fowler, right? We then wanted to test whether or not what the dynamics were, whether or not it was just because the effect estimate was too small to matter, right? And so what we did is we just inflated the effect estimate parameter. So rather than increasing your risk for becoming obese by 57%, this now increased your risk. We changed the model such that having an obese contact increased the risk of obesity among another contact by 1,000%, 10 times. Okay, so now obesity is looking a little bit more like an infectious disease in this model. Okay. And then we reran both interventions, and we asked the same exact question. Does targeting the most well-connected individuals in the model improve the efficacy of the intervention when the communicability parameter of obesity is substantially higher? Okay? And here's what we found. As you now might expect, when obesity is imminently communicable, the targeted intervention, which is in red, outperformed the intervention implemented at random in blue. Okay? And the intervention itself was substantially more efficacious. All right? We then looked at the treatment intervention and found something quite paradoxical. In fact, with respect to treatment, we found that the at-random intervention was more efficacious than the targeted intervention. We wanted to understand why, and so we built this very simple toy model to understand the dynamics of it. Now, we have a really well-connected individual here in the middle and a number of friends on the peripheries, okay, who are substantially less well-connected. Let's imagine this individual on the periphery here becomes obese. What he's going to do in the next time step is push obesogeneity into the middle of the model, okay? The next time step, what would you expect? The well-connected individual is going to become obese. Now what happens? He pushes obesogeneity out into the whole periphery, such that everybody becomes obese. Now, in the same time step, we're also treating him, okay? So he's going to get cured of the obesity, even though he's now pushed obesity outward into the rest of the model. So what you get here is a number of people on the peripheries who are obese, and this individual in the middle who's been cured. Now, this is the revenge of the nerds. They push obesogeneity back into the middle of the model, okay, such that everybody ends up obese. Now, to test whether or not this was the dynamic, again, we can do implausible things in these models that allow us to really get at the dynamics. All we did is we made the treatment intervention permanent, such that we wouldn't expect this rebound pushback back into the middle of the model. Does that make sense? And what we found is that paradoxical effect went away when we made that treatment effect permanent, such that those dynamics I was showing you are very likely to be what's operating when we think about the dynamics of the spread of obesity in a network. More importantly, stepping back, though, what this suggests to us is that with respect to a very complex etiology, obesity being a very complex disease, the influence of social networks, even if it's there, just is not important enough to warrant targeting interventions toward it. So it's not necessarily worth our money to find the most well-connected people and target them when we have a limited intervention space. And just to bring us conceptually back, what we're doing here is contrasting different exposures of interest and validating using a realistic baseline population. I want to thank my collaborators on this project and funders. Thank you.